From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, how much of unemployment benefits affected hiring in the U.S.?
One girl put it very, very blunt to me. She said, I know I make less to take the unemployment, but when am I ever going to get to make this much money to sit home and have a great summer?
The Delta variant, why it's created even more of a sense of urgency to get people vaccinated.
When there's widespread transmission around the globe, it is far too soon to declare victory here in the United States, even though the numbers here in the U.S. are looking really, really good.
And how space travel has affected the way we talk on planet Earth.
We think we're going to see a lot more of space lingo making its way into our daily lives because we're really at the dawn of a new space age.
All ahead on Perspective. President Biden is on his first overseas trip this weekend ahead of his summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who may or may not have heavily influenced the spate of recent ransomware attacks seen on American companies. That discussion happens next week. This week, the president is telling leaders of the G7 nations during their first in-person summit since the pandemic that he sees an urgent need to mend relationships that were strained under the previous administration. The big photos and entourages that you typically see at these summits have been limited due to the continued COVID restrictions, but the president is still hoping to leverage his influence and the influence of the U.S. to work with allies to take on global issues. ABC News White House correspondent Karen Travers is the only network news reporter traveling with the president. I talked with her this week from Cornwall, England, about the president's trip and what's ahead for that all-important meeting with Vladimir Putin. This is the first face-to-face G7 summit trip for President Biden and for, you know, all of these, you know, world leaders. I mean, they're coming out of COVID. I almost feel like they're sort of like the cicadas coming out of the ground. Like, what do we do? But really, it has been a long time since these guys have seen each other face-to-face. What's the most important thing that President Biden has to do on this trip or you think should do on this trip to kind of, I don't know, restore, faith in American leadership?
Yeah, you know, that's been the big message from the White House. It's one of the first things the president said when he landed in England earlier this week. He said the United States is back. And that's a big part of his message, convincing these European allies that the United States is with them and that this is a turning of the page from the 4 years of the Trump administration. The president's here to repair relationships with allies and relationships that he says were damaged over the past 4 years. Now, that's, of course, a very political perspective. President Trump did have some solid relationships with some of these leaders on certain issues, but overall, you certainly get this sense that the G7 leaders are eager to engage with President Biden, but they're also a little wary, and they're waiting to see what he does before, I think, that full embrace.
Is there one main overriding message to this, you know, the economy coming back after the pandemic, or is it a series of many things that you mentioned, you know, sort of the restoration of democracy? But is there one message or are there many?
I think the big issue that these world leaders are discussing, no surprise, is the COVID pandemic. And from that comes the recovery of the global economy. The president, before sitting down with the G7 world leaders, announced that the United States would be donating 500 million doses of Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine to COVAX, which is the global immunization effort. And the president, when he announced this, framed this as part of the message of the United States is back. He says that under his leadership, America is once again a global leader. And on this, the biggest challenge facing the planet right now, the United States is in a position to take such a big step like this. And he's urging the other countries to come along.
So let's look ahead as to what will happen after the G7 summit. There is a meeting, first of all, with NATO leaders in Brussels. And one of the very first things that President Trump did when he came into office was, you know, say the U.S. wants more from these NATO countries or we're pulling ourselves out. What is their thoughts now with a new administration and a new president?
Yeah, again, it's getting back to the America is with you again. The president at the NATO summit is going to reaffirm his administration's commitment to the military alliance. And that was a commitment that was not guaranteed over the 4 years of the Trump administration. I traveled multiple times to Brussels with former President Trump when he did NATO summits. He also did one in London with NATO alliance leaders. And that message was always very tenuous. It's going to be a very different message from President Biden at the NATO summit. He is firmly committed to this military alliance. And, you know, he's going to, again, so similar to the G7 message is we're back. And under my leadership, things are different.
Okay, now let's move on to the big meeting with Vladimir Putin that will happen next week. The White House has already started downplaying expectations for this, saying, you know, don't expect too much to come out of this. What can we expect to come out of that?
It's been striking to see senior administration officials over the past 2 weeks say that there is really no sense that a concrete agreement is going to come out of this meeting between President Biden and President Putin, that there might not even be a major breakthrough. And there have been a lot of questions then about why even do it? And White House officials, including the National Security Advisor, say, look, if you're waiting around to schedule a meeting with a Russian president until you know you will have something to come out of it, you might be waiting a really long time. And that the conversation itself is very important to President Biden. When he first landed in England earlier last week, he was speaking to U.S. service members, and he described the meeting with Putin as an opportunity for him to let him know what I want him to know. And he paused and shared. There was a big applause from the U.S. service members. And you got a sense that the president was trying to do a little bit of a swagger ahead of this meeting, because certainly Vladimir Putin will be doing the same thing. But really, this is a chance, White House officials say, for the president to look him in the eye, to have this conversation in person. And we expect him, according to the White House, to put pressure on Putin on cyber attacks, Russia's election interference, human rights violations, and aggression against Ukraine.
Karen, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about the cicadas on the press plane. Got a lot of news this week. What happened with that?
So we were scheduled to leave Washington, D.C. at 9 p.m. Eastern time on Tuesday night. We got there and they told us there was a problem with the plane. We'd be delayed for a couple of hours. Then those couple of hours went by and they said, we're still a little delayed. We're waiting for another plane to come because the original plane had cicadas in the engine. And that meant that we might not be able to take off. So we waited a couple more hours. And finally, at about 4 a.m. on Wednesday, another plane arrived for us and we were able to take off. So it got off to a bit of a rocky start. But Sherry, I got to say, we've been kind of joking about, like, are we confident that a couple didn't sneak onto that second plane? Because if in 17 years, there's a story out of Cornwall about this very strange bug emergence, the White House press is going to be blamed for it.
ABC's Karen Travers from Cornwall, England, traveling with President Biden on his big first overseas trip as president. Thanks, Karen.
Thanks, Sherry.
Back here in the U.S., cybersecurity is becoming a big topic of conversation as every business and public institution faces the threat of ransomware. We have seen two big companies pay millions already to protect vital information.
We're not talking about people with conscience. We're talking about criminals who want to make money illegally, or who want to do harm independent of a profit motive.
Unconscionable. That's how Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas described the hackers this week to ABC News. ABC Chief Law and Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas has more on what the government's trying to do about it.
The FBI director with a stark warning. Ransomware attacks costing U.S. companies millions of dollars have tripled in the last year, and that may be just the beginning.
So the scale of this is something that I don't think this country's ever seen anything quite like it, and it's going to get much worse.
Ray says the FBI is investigating more than 100 ransomware attacks, each case with dozens if not hundreds of victims, and he's urging companies not to give in to extortion.
Companies should not pay the ransom for a number of reasons. It encourages more of this kind of activity.
U.S. companies have been under incredible pressure. Food giant JBS now confirming it paid $11 million to cyber criminals after a ransomware attack closed its meat plants across the U.S. This after Colonial Pipeline paid $4.4 million in ransom after an attack that ended up closing gas stations along the East Coast. But the Homeland Security Secretary, in an exclusive interview at his agency's Cyber Command Center, acknowledged that companies are being put in an impossible situation.
We've lost $350 million in ransomware alone this year. more than 300% increase over last year.
Many companies simply are not doing enough, but some are starting to get the message. Some even going as far as hiring their own professional hackers to hunt for weaknesses.
ABC News Chief Law and Justice Correspondent Pierre Thomas. We got two big signs of how the economy is recovering this week. First, inflation. The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that consumer prices were up 5% compared to a year ago, the biggest surge since we began coming out of the Great Recession in August of 2008. Then, jobs. 376,000 people filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week, a high number, but still the lowest since the pandemic began. With the country reopening and people clamoring to get back to doing the things they once did, companies are on a hiring spree. But a lot of them say they can't find workers. ABC News Chief Business and Economics Correspondent Rebecca Jarvis has more on that.
U.S. job openings soaring to a record 9.3 million. A new report from the Labor Department showing openings surged in April, and the number of Americans who voluntarily quit their jobs rose to nearly 4 million. So who's hiring? Virtually every industry in every region of the country. Retail openings up 559,000 from this time last year. Manufacturing up 579,000. And in leisure and hospitality, 1.2 million more jobs available than last April. But while the jobs are returning, many businesses say the applications are not. Goldman Sachs' 10,000 Small Businesses Voices survey finding 71% are currently hiring, but 81% of them say they're finding it difficult to recruit qualified candidates.
The issue of unemployment is a complicated one. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze reports on the extended unemployment benefits and whether they are keeping workers at home as the economy reopens.
You don't know if you're going to be able to make ends meet.
When Rebecca Urey lost her job as a lab technician in West Virginia last March, her biggest fear was caring for her two autistic children, Wyatt and Allison.
Both of them have specialized care, and you just don't know from one minute to the next if you're going to keep your health insurance to take care of your children's needs.
Then came a lifeline, hundreds of dollars in extra weekly federal unemployment benefits.
There's no way that we could have survived without the federal supplement.
But West Virginia's governor says those benefits are causing a problem in the jobs market.
Our businesses are pleading with our people. We got to have you back to work.
He's one of the 25 Republican governors now putting an early end to the extra $300 a week in federal unemployment benefits. The payments were originally funded through September 6th as part of the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. The White House insists the expanded unemployment insurance is essential for the economic recovery. But after job growth missed expectations, Republican lawmakers called for an end to the federal jobless benefits, saying they're disincentivizing Americans from returning to work.
We should not still be taxing the Americans who are working to fund continued extra benefits for those staying home.
It's a message amplified by businesses from coast to coast that are struggling to find workers.
I'm just not sure extra unemployment benefits are necessary at this point.
Sarah White manages three restaurants in Virginia. She's desperate for workers and says only one out of every 10 applicants shows up to interview.
One girl put it very, very blunt to me. She said, I know I make less to take the unemployment, but when am I ever going to get to make this much money to sit home and have a great summer?
Some employers are reporting an uptick in job applications after some states announced they were ending the federal benefits early. But economists argue expanded unemployment benefits are a small piece of the worker shortage puzzle. Research by the San Francisco Fed estimates the $300 enhanced weekly benefits had just a small effect on job finding rates at the beginning of this year. One explanation for the current worker shortage is that the economy went from shut down to fully reopened in a matter of weeks as vaccinations ramped up. Economists also say a lack of childcare is a key reason why Americans aren't returning to work, pointing to the more than 2 million women who've dropped out of the labor force since last February. For the past year, Rebecca Urey says she's been applying for up to 30 jobs a week and still isn't getting any calls back.
You have so many people with now hiring signs, but they're not the type of companies that will work with your needs if you have a special needs child.
I think some of our employees are still struggling through that decision and that issue.
Nicole Marquis is the founder and CEO of 7 restaurants in Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia.
As a single mom, I totally sympathize with parents out there.
She says other employees were nervous about coming back to work because of COVID health risks, and some switched industries altogether. Facing her own worker shortage, Marquis announced her restaurants would raise wages to a minimum of $15 an hour. Job applications surged.
I think our employees are demanding this. We've got to pay them a starting fair wage.
Some, like 31-year-old Maya Clark, who was laid off from her job last March, say these wage hikes were overdue for essential workers who've been hit hardest during the pandemic.
But wouldn't you invest into your employee who's a great employee, who's been there the longest, who's shown you that, you know, they're willing to come in early, willing to work late? Wouldn't you pay them what they're worth?
And Elizabeth is here now to talk more about it. So let's talk about where we are as far as unemployment benefits. Kind of stunning news from the Bureau of Labor Statistics saying there's more than 9 million job openings right now. It's the most ever. What can you tell us about that and the enhanced unemployment benefits that a lot of people have said have helped them survive through the pandemic, but that might be one of the reasons they're not going back to work?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty surprising that we have all of these job openings. We keep hearing anecdotes from businesses really across the country who are struggling to find workers. Yet the latest jobs report showed there are still nearly 8 million people out of work compared to before the pandemic. So it seems unusual that you would have this high unemployment rate and this high rate of job openings. But there are a couple of different explanations for what's going on. And one of them, a lot are pointing to these expanded unemployment benefits. A lot of states, 25 states, all led by Republican governors, have said those benefits are too generous and they're preventing people from going back to work. That's why we have this huge worker shortage right now. Evidence of that, and what a lot of economists I'm speaking to and workers I'm speaking with say, it's a little bit more complicated than that. There are a couple of other bigger factors that could be preventing people from going back to work.
What are some of those other reasons?
So, you know, one big factor right now is a lack of childcare. There have been about 2 million women who have dropped out of the workforce since the start of the pandemic. And generally, a lot of childcares are already full for the summer. So women are saying, I have to hold back on going back to work until I have a more predictable childcare schedule here. So that could be one factor. Another factor is just concerns about COVID still. You know, some workers who worked in industries like restaurants where really you were around a lot of people, it was crowded, they might be hesitant to go back to those jobs. Even if they're vaccinated, you know, there's still a little bit of hesitancy there. Plus, they may not want to play bad cop when it comes to telling people to wear their masks or not. That's something that we saw a lot of workers skeptical about. And then the other big reason right now that a lot of economists are talking about is just that we are in this moment that is completely unusual for the economy, where we went from this very low point to this very high point as things have opened up extremely quickly as more people have gotten vaccinated. And the reality is that it just takes a little bit of time for the workforce to catch up. And generally, you know, it's just going to be a little bit of a bumpy road as we get back to this hopefully full employment sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I want to talk about that sea change in how we're all working these days. I mean, we figured out how to do it in different ways. Is there a chance that we might see these openings for jobs for some time to come? Because some people are saying, you know, I like working part time. I like staying home with my kids more. I like seeing more of my kids because I'm not commuting. Is there a chance that these openings could remain for some time?
There absolutely is. And some people may have switched industries during this past year and found out that they actually liked those other jobs more, that they were more flexible. You know, driving for Uber, for example, you might have more control over your hours than if you were working as a server at a restaurant. Some of the low-wage industries that really were a lot of the essential jobs, restaurants, leisure, hospitality, those sectors are, there are signs that they are now raising wages as a way to kind of lure workers back into the workforce and to continue to get them to stay in those industries instead of going elsewhere. And some economists, and frankly, a lot of workers say that's not such a bad thing, that it's time for them to pay more, to have better retention, and that maybe the pandemic was really the tipping point for some of those workers to realize that they should be demanding more from their employers.
ABC's Elizabeth Schulze on unemployment in the U.S. as we come out of the pandemic. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, jazz musicians getting back on stage, how they weathered the pandemic, and what might change in the future on Perspective after this.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective, this week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, the world's richest man will soon become the galaxy's richest man for 11 minutes. But first, so some people may not want to go back to their old jobs, and some people just can't go back to their old jobs for a number of reasons. For others who want to return to work, work may look and sound very different once they get back. Let's take jazz musicians. I spoke with a couple of them who perform regularly or did perform regularly here in New York City before the pandemic. They talked about how this past year and a half has changed everything and how it will change in the months ahead as the city reopens. Across the country, you've seen the signs. Help wanted. There's been debate back and forth about why so many businesses are looking for so many people. Some say the enhanced unemployment benefits make it more beneficial for folks to stay at home, especially if they have young kids. One thing is certain. Those unemployment checks and the eviction moratorium that runs out at the end of this month have been lifesavers for gig workers. And not just Uber drivers and DoorDash deliverers. Some of those gig workers are musicians. Mitch Borner is a drummer and the former owner of Small's Jazz Club in New York's West Village. We met at a party over Memorial Day where he told me there are two types of musicians.
There's the devoted ones that will only play music and not have a day job. And they can hustle, but there's a certain way of living. They have to live on the bare minimum. You know, those are rare people. But then there's a second tier of musicians that have a day job, and they usually don't get to that level, you know, that the devoted musician gets to, but the life is much easier.
And during the pandemic, both types of musicians found themselves without an income. Brian Marcella plays keyboards in several bands and vividly remembers when the lockdown began in March of 2020.
When things shut down, in my mind, regardless of what they said, I knew it was going to be a long time. My plan was that there wasn't going to be really live performances until, you know, probably like the fall of 2021, and it seems that we might be a little bit ahead of that.
Marcella is lucky enough to tour the world, but he found himself struggling to pay the bills, even though he's one of those musicians with a side job.
I teach at the New School in Manhattan, so we went, you know, online in the fall, so I still had a job to teach. Our hours got, you know, cut a lot of students. The enrollment dropped a lot for the last year. So a lot of courses, you know, were cut. My hours went down, but it allowed me to also collect unemployment. It was amazing, and, you know, it was great for the gig workers were able to get it.
And as jazz musicians scrambled to make ends meet, so did the clubs they used to frequent.
They started to open last fall, and then they closed again in the winter when things got worse again. But I've had a number of recording projects. So sort of between that and fortunately I was lucky enough to have savings.
Marcella says many of his friends aren't teachers and don't tour. So for them, it was really rough.
particularly playing jazz, and you know, our life has never been easy. We've never had it easy, and I feel like artists are really resilient, and they find a way. Would we have been able to find a way without the pandemic assistance? Probably not. So that did save a lot of the musicians that I know.
Another thing that has helped gig workers through the pandemic has been the moratorium on evictions. Federal protections have kept people from being tossed out of their homes or apartments. At the end of the month, those protections expire. Landlords have already begun the paperwork in some places. And drummer Larry Estreffi says that's worrisome because to him, losing live music was like losing a limb.
It's like somebody's cutting your legs and your arms, your head, you know, slowly, it's killing you slowly. Because this, the whole culture lives from that, you know, like music is out there, people need to go out and see.
Small's Jazz Club in the West Village was able to get a PPP loan to stay afloat, and it rode out the pandemic. Now they're back to offering live jazz most nights of the week. And these musicians say they plan to keep on playing there, and also for free at places like this. The Delta variant of the coronavirus that first developed in India has been popping up around the world, including here in the U.S. It's 40% more transmissible, and patients are slower to show symptoms. Pfizer is on the final frontier as it begins COVID vaccine trials for kids ages 5 to 11, and Moderna has filed for emergency use authorization for its shot to be given to anyone over the age of 12. This week, the president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the former CDC acting director, Dr. Richard Besser, talked about that Delta variant and new vaccines for children with ABC's Robin Roberts.
This new Delta variant, how concerned should we be about this?
Well, I mean, Robin, the good news about the Delta variant is that the vaccines that are currently being used are effective against the Delta variant. But what it says to me is that when there's widespread transmission around the globe, it is far too soon to declare victory here in the United States, even though the numbers here in the U.S. are looking really, really good. They're going down in just about every state.
But still knowing this, what kind of precautions should families take who have unvaccinated children?
You know, the Delta virus points to the fact that kids are at risk. That strain, it appears, affects children at a greater rate. And so even though the numbers are going down, you need to be careful around kids, especially kids who have medical conditions like asthma.
Pfizer in the final phase trials for children ages 5 to 11. So what do you say, though, to parents? There's a lot of concern. There are a lot of parents who do not want to get their children vaccinated.
Wait for the studies to be done. Look at what's taking place here and around the world. Look at what the recommendations are, and then make an informed decision. Make sure all of your questions are answered so you can make a decision as to whether vaccination is right for your child. While children in general do quite well with this virus, they can spread it to others who don't. Vaccinating children may be an important part of the way we try and knock this out for good.
Rich, it's always good to see you, and we'll always appreciate your insight. Thank you, Rich.
The rate of COVID vaccinations in the U.S. has been slowing down. In fact, there's a chance the country may not hit its target of getting 70% of American adults at least one shot by the 4th of July. Some are still hesitant to get the shot. And this week, ABC News producer Megan Stone has more on how you might be able to help somebody you know who might be a little wary of that vaccine.
At the start of the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci told us how many Americans would need to be vaccinated before we safely turn the tide on COVID-19.
I'm talking about herd immunity, which I project would require between 70 and 85% of the population being vaccinated.
As it stands today, slightly over 60% of Americans over the age of 12 have received at least one dose. People have been offered free beer, free childcare, a chance at free airfare, and cold hard cash. But with all that has been done, there are still millions of Americans who are reluctant to take the shot. Some people have readily admitted they don't trust the science, and pediatrician Dr. Jade Coburn with the ABC News Medical Unit says that's understandable.
We are now in a world where we have access to terms from the medical and scientific community that people never talked about before. Herd immunity, mRNA vaccination technology. It can be a lot for people to wrap their mind around in that type of defense of not understanding some of the research, some of the language. language, sometimes it can come off very confusing. And it may just be easier for people to lean back on those conspiracy theories and kind of say, well, this is just easier for me to understand.
One man who asked to remain anonymous tells ABC News his brother is one of those people, even though their father is compromised and is depending on people like us to get the shot.
My brother, he doesn't get his information from traditional news media. He said the news is used to scare people, sensationalize, and titillate. Every conversation is the same. And he always tries to deflect or change the subject. I haven't even read some of the stuff that he shared with my father and me. He thinks that if you get enough vitamin D, you'll be fine.
So what can you do to combat misinformation? Dr. Coburn says asking your family doctor for help is one of the best things you can do.
It is important to talk about the concerns. Find the facts from people that you trust, your family members, your doctor. Let those people be your lifeboat in the sea of misinformation that exists. They can help guide you.
On the other hand, one of the worst things you can do is ridicule those who are fearful of getting the shot.
It's important for people with hesitancy to feel heard, to not dismiss their hesitancy, to not dismiss their concerns. It's become so much more important to talk about and directly address those concerns and actively seek out those people around us in our communities who are still hesitant to get vaccinated and say, hey, I want to hear your concerns. What can I do or tell you about my story that might be helpful in you making your decision?
Doctors say the people who have the biggest impact on those who are reluctant are those they trust, their friends, family members, and coworkers. And sometimes it actually does come down to the chance at winning $1 million.
I kept hemming and hawing about it, and I work all the time, and then when the vaccine thing started, I immediately went down there and got it.
That's Jonathan Carlisle speaking right after he played the weekly vaccine lottery in Ohio and won. Reporting for Perspective, Megan Stone, ABC News.
We're launching the richest man on the planet into space.
I want to go on this flight because it's a thing I've wanted to do all my life. It's an adventure. It's a big deal for me.
Well, he's launching himself into space. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos announcing on Instagram this week that he will be exiting the atmosphere with his company Blue Origin for 11 minutes, joined by his brother and another passenger who'll be paying millions of dollars for that other seat. So what are we going to say once they get back next month? Are we going to call the trip of Bezos a prime opportunity? Space has had a lot of influence over our everyday language. There are words and phrases we use all the time that weren't around prior to space travel. Glitch, abort, launch, uplink, those are just a few. How about Houston, we have a problem? You've probably used that phrase more than once, and it might not have had anything to do with space. I got to talk recently with Julie Hansen, the U.S. CEO of the language learning app Babbel, about how space has influenced our vocabulary.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth.
60th anniversary of JFK's moonshot speech delivered before Congress, marking the beginning of the country's ventures into space. How has space changed our language? What kinds of words are we saying now that we weren't saying 60 years ago?
Well, we've picked up a whole bunch of words from the space missions. They're slang. We use them in a slang way, but some of them we actually even just use routinely. So routine words are things like abort.
Mission abort. Repeat. Mission abort. Initiate emergency.
You know, to cancel or cut short a mission, or downlink and uplink to send radio signals up or down to Earth from a spacecraft. Glitch. I did not know that was that came from the space travels, but it did.
How long does it take for words like that to become a part of the lexicon and to use them in our everyday language?
Some are kind of instantaneous because they capture the imagination. You know, they get absorbed into popular culture and very quickly picked up by people. They're fun, you know, they add spice to the language, if you will. And then others take longer because they're more obscure and we have to understand what they mean, like, you know, zero gravity. That's a weird concept. So we have to hear that a few times, maybe see the crazy zero gravity machines to start repeating that.
How often do you think people repeat screw the pooch? Because that's definitely a NASA and astronaut lingo word. First of all, what does it mean and where did it come from?
We at Babbel, we did a little research on that topic. And you're right that it did come from, it legitimately came from NASA lingo. I think it got popularized from the movie The Right Stuff.
Just watch you don't screw the pooch.
It means what you think it means. maybe slightly more polite way of saying the crude version of don't mess up.
Another one that I love that you guys have come up with is puffy head bird legs.
Hello, astronaut Randy Bresnik. I'm here to talk to you about puffy head bird legs, because that's what happens to us when we get to orbit.
And that's not something you might say on a daily basis, but boy, is that a good phrase. Puffy head bird legs. What does it mean?
Yeah, that's a great one. Babel research into that one found that it means the congested head and wobbly legs that astronauts get when they first escape gravity, because fluid in your body is allowed to move around. The gravity is not pulling the fluid to your feet. And so it puffs up your head and your legs feel skinny and wobbly, which is really evocative of what it must be like to be an astronaut trying to walk under those conditions.
You know, it's hard to think back, you know, pre 60 years ago when these words did become normal. What about NASA itself? I mean, that's one of those words that, you know, comes from the linking up of other words. Is that something that we see a lot of?
Sure. But I think we're going to see a lot more of space lingo making its way into our daily lives, because we're really at the dawn of a new space age. I mean, with the commercial space flights that are suddenly becoming a reality. I mean, you've got three household names of big companies that are looking to take people into space.
You see the Earth from space, and it changes you. It changes your relationship with this planet, with humanity. It's one Earth.
There's a lot of excitement all of a sudden about space that there hasn't been for decades. And I think that what we'll see is astronauts continuing to evolve the language to make it efficient for them, because, you know, they have to be able to communicate quickly and clearly to the other people on the flight that need to do things. But I still think we'll also continue to get spicy fun stuff like,
Houston, we have a problem.
We can look forward to more phrases like that coming into our daily speech. I mean, how often do you not find yourself saying that one? That's just a classic.
I know. And I tell you something, every time I screw up, I screw the pooch every single time. I'm just kidding. This is really interesting. A guide to astronaut lingo and how space has changed the way we talk and the way we speak. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Finally this week, June is Pride Month. So ABC's Jim Ryan's got a story from Texas about rainbow cookies.
A week ago, Confections Bakery in Lufkin, Texas was a tiny unknown shop owned by two sisters. The women posted pictures of the rainbow-decorated cookies they'd made for Pride Month and heard a quick and angry response from some customers, some of whom canceled orders. Then, says Miranda Dolder, came the positive comments and the business.
I was shocked at the outpouring of support. Families waiting like 2 hours in line to get a cookie.
A week after posting the rainbow cookies, Confections Facebook page has 70,000 followers and requests for cookies from across North America.
They gave me a piece of hope, and I appreciate them for it.
And if you go to the Confections Facebook page now, you'll find it filled with messages of support that have been pouring in all week long. And they've also raised over $5,000 for the Lufkin High School Club Diversity Scholarship Fund. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.